Good evening, everyone. I'm Lenore Moudou. Welcome to Health Chat. Have you ever had surgery? Well, if yes, you will probably agree that a diagnosis of having to undergo surgery could be very stressful. The risks and safety of the surgery, as well as the expertise of the surgeon, are some of the concerns patients often have to face. Today's Health Chat is a special program as we will profile an African surgeon who is doing exceptional work here in the United States. Dr. Kofi Derek Owusu-Bohin is associate professor at Johns Hopkins Medical Institute and one of its lead surgeons. I sat with Dr. Bohin to discuss the work of a surgeon and the challenges of addressing surgeries and healthcare in some African countries. Here is my exclusive interview. Dr. Kofi Derek Owusu-Bohin, thank you so much for joining us here at Voice of America.
Thank you for having me.
You are one of the lead surgeons at Johns Hopkins University. Tell us about what you do on a daily basis.
The work of what we call an academic physician is a little bit different. So I'm a teacher. So when I go, I'm going to be training medical students and people who are training to be surgeons. And I'm a healer, so I'm taking care of people who come to me daily. But when we pin it down to what my specialty is, I do facial plastics and reconstructive surgery. So surgery limited to the face only. And it can be children born with congenital problems that you have to fix, or people who are deformed from car accidents, or people who, for the unfortunate circumstance of having had cancer removed, have to have a reconstructive surgery done. So that's probably about 50% of what I do. And then the rest will be finding ways to take brain tumors out or tumors that are hidden under the skull of the brain. So I combine sort of two expertise.
When you work on facial paralysis, what type of technique do you use to be able to make the face move again?
So I concentrate mostly on the face. You know, people asked me, so of all the things, why did you decide to work on the face? The face is the first thing that we recognize. It's our source of confidence. What we see in the mirror in the morning is what sets our mood for the rest of the day. When somebody's face is paralyzed, it's demoralizing. So it's one of the things that I actually find joy in doing. So in facial paralysis, there can be many causes. And one of the most common causes is a simple viral infection. You can be pregnant. During the last trimester of your pregnancy, you wake up one morning and your face doesn't move. Very scary thought. So usually when someone comes to me and has paralysis of the face, I'm looking at what the cause is. Is it a nerve problem? Is it a muscle problem? How long has the paralysis been? And usually we are trying to connect nerves and muscles together to get the face to work again.
So what is the success rate in facial paralysis?
Very, very high. The thing that determines the success is how timely our intervention is. So if someone has paralysis of the face and comes to see me within 3 to 6 months, there's a very high chance we can get the face to move. If they come 2 years, 3 years after the fact, we can still restore their facial movement, but it takes a little bit more surgery. You have to go get a muscle from one part of the body and bring it to the face, connect blood vessels and connect nerves. So almost all spectrum, you can do something to restore movement.
So what would you say is one of the most challenging surgeries that you have to do?
The spectrum is broad. Challenging sometimes in terms of the length of surgery. Some surgeries can go up to 12 hours and you don't move. And most of them has to do with taking tumors out under the brain, because there are so many important structures in a very small area. And if you move half a centimeter in the wrong way, you can kill someone. And usually you are on the edge throughout those testing moments. But the reward at the end is quite huge when you can walk to someone's family and tell them everything went well.
What does it take to be a good surgeon? Of course, you have to go to school, to training and everything, but what other qualities do you think?
I've been asked that question several times. I really don't know how I got to where I am. I think patience. You know, we in surgery, we say you learn how to do something, but you have to look good doing it. Meaning you do it without leaving telltale signs that you were ever there. So that when you're done, you are restoring function to the person, but not disrupting too much stuff. So patience is a big one. And I think practice and practice and practice is the other one. And more importantly, you shouldn't be very scared of looking at blood, which to me was the opposite, because I started off in life could not stand the sight of blood.
So you say you started from not liking blood to today dealing with blood almost every day. Tell us, what was one of the key moments that determined your career today?
Going back to that story about blood, I have 7 siblings. 3 of us are physicians. Amongst us all, I'm the last one that my parents ever thought would be a physician, let alone be a surgeon. Because every time there was blood, I always shied away. But there was a telling experience that I had when I was in high school, boarding school, where one of our schoolmates got injured in a car accident, and we had to carry him as 16-year-olds to a hospital. And that was where a turning point really happened, that you find yourself with a schoolmate, helpless. You think he's going to die, and there's no help for that person. And all around you, there's pain and groaning in the morning, and not enough doctors to take care of. And that was an experience that I didn't like. And I said, you know, I'm going to come back and change this. And along the line in the story, it really did happen that I was able to contribute to change things in that hospital. My experience with being exposed to so much blood, blood of my friend, helped me overcome my fears and start making the steps toward being a surgeon that I am today.
And when you thought about becoming a doctor, was when you were looking at a book and you saw Mayo Clinic?
You know, my parents, as a birthday gift, actually used to buy encyclopedia, just a bunch of them. And in one of them, I had read about the Mayo Clinic. And Mayo Clinic, of course, if you know anything about it, it's in Rochester, Minnesota. Yes. It was started by a father and his 2 sons. The father used to be a chemist. My dad was a chemist. So I related to that story. But at that age, I really didn't understand what it meant for a boy growing up in Ghana to say, I'm going to work at Mayo Clinic. It was just a dream. And I thought Mayo Clinic was just right next door. That concept didn't connect to me. And years later, it sort of happened, and in retrospect, it's been an amazing journey.
An amazing journey, but also very challenging and full of miracles. I mean, that's what my take on
exactly.
It. Tell us one of the key moments where you thought, you know, this is really what I'm supposed to do. You saw a big challenge, but then you saw the resolve of that challenge, and you understood that you were on the right path.
I can count on many what I call my Samaritan moments. But the thing that stands out clearly to me, when I moved from the Soviet Union to the US to start school, to get my requirements to go into medical school, I actually got admitted in 1994, which was very quick for a foreign student. So I got in what we call an early admission to the University of Arkansas Medical School. And I thought this was too easy. I had been in the country for 2 years. I was focused, that's what I wanted to do. And I got in. But at the last moment, like a week before school starts, I was told, you know, you're an international student and you can't come to this state school. I had held an admission letter from January to August. All the papers had gone through. So that to me was, this was not meant to happen. So I turned my attention to find what other means, alternatives I had. I applied to graduate schools. And then the following year, I applied to medical schools again. And when I did, I got in again. And this time, finances was the stumbling block. And one of my professors was just jogging and running along, saw me on the roadside and asked me, are you going to go to med school this time? He knew what had happened the previous year. And I told him I wasn't sure. And when I told him the details about finances, he said, come talk to me the next day. And how he helped me then, you know, out of the blue, told me maybe this was meant to be.
Well, that was Dr. Kofi Owusu-Bohin. We will continue our discussion with Dr. Bohin in a moment. It's time for a short break. And before we go on break, here's the latest health news with Eva Yuma. Hello, Eva.
Hello. The World Health Organization has released the global guidelines for the prevention of surgical site infections. These guidelines are a culmination of the latest research, resulting in a list of 29 recommendations. They aim to address the increasing burden of healthcare-associated infections on both patients and healthcare systems globally. Among other reasons, surgical site infections are caused by bacteria that get in through incisions made during surgery. The guidelines were also published in The Lancet Infectious Diseases. New research shows that antiretroviral drugs can reduce the viral load in the blood and semen of HIV-positive individuals much quicker than before. Researchers in Spain say the new drug dolutegravir suppressed the viral load in seminal fluid to virtually undetectable levels more quickly than older ARVs. While antiretroviral agents usually suppress the virus in the blood to undetectable levels within 6 months, researchers say HIV remains detectable in semen in up to 25% of patients after that time. The Spanish researchers say dolutegravir has the potential to reduce the chances of sexual transmission of HIV. The findings are published in the Journal of Infectious Diseases. And in other HIV news, a new clinical trial is underway in South Africa on an experimental vaccine that could safely prevent HIV. According to a statement from the U.S. National Institutes of Health, the NIH, the HVTN-702 is the largest and most advanced HIV vaccine clinical trial to be undertaken in South Africa, where some 7 million people are living with the virus. The new study is based on the one conducted in Thailand in 2009, led by the U.S. Military HIV Research Program and the Thai Ministry of Health. It proved for the first time that an AIDS vaccine was possible. It looked at a vaccine candidate called RV144, but it only offered a protection rate of 31%. The new trial hopes to provide a higher and sustainable protection rate, and the results of the clinical trial are expected in 2020. And that's a wrap of the latest health news. Back to you, Lenore.
Thank you, Eva. And that was Eva with the news. And welcome back to our listeners. If you're just joining us late on this episode of Health Chat, we are talking to Dr. Kofi Boheni. He's Associate Professor at Johns Hopkins Medical Institute. In part two of our discussion, we talk about his work in Africa, as well as his newly published book, However Far the Stream Flows, in which he shares his personal journey from Ghana to becoming an acclaimed surgeon here in the United States. Take a listen. Now let's talk about the medical missions that you go on with some colleagues. Tell us about what prompted you to start and some of your experiences on your field.
Anyone who has been through the medical system as a physician in the U.S. will realize that sometimes the constraints of health reform, laws, insurance company takes the joy out of taking care of people. But when you go on medical missions, all those restrictions are taken away. It's where really you are able to take care of people who are really in need, and you see the appreciation that comes from it. Why did I get started in all this? My dad is a missionary, he's a pastor. So when I was growing up, I saw people come from the US, age 19, 20, they would come and spend months learning how to build small churches, giving of their time. There were some doctors who also came and took care of people. And you see that and you say, well, why did they come all over from their country to your country to come and help? And it sort of sparks a light in you. So when I got the opportunity, I took it. My first medical mission was to a small town called Oaxaca in Mexico, and haven't looked back since then.
What about working in Africa?
So in Africa, I have gone to Liberia several times. I've gone to Rwanda at least 5 times, Nigeria and Ghana. In Liberia specifically, one of the most common surgeries we do is fixing cleft lips. And I went to Liberia after the Civil War. It's an amazing thing to see. One of the hospitals that I worked at was called Phoebe Hospital. It's one of the hospitals that during the Civil War, the soldiers came in and people were hidden in closets and just killed a lot of people. The whole place was just ransacked. And in the hospital yard, you see people who are buried. And some are people who survived, and they tell you their stories. And children with their ears cut off, noses cut off, children growing up with cleft lips not fixed. And when I'm able to make a change, I think, you know, I have made an impact in a country that was war-torn. The reward is amazing. As I wrote in the book, when giants fight, two elephants fight, it's the grass that suffers. Yes. All the children during that time were suffering because of this adult problem of a civil war. Other countries with similar histories, Rwanda, And as we go on medical missions, you can see some of the aftermaths of those wars, but they have made significant progress. So in medical missions, we get to be able to practice our trade, so-called trade, and really give back and to people who are called the least amongst us.
When you look at the health system in some of the countries, and you made a good point about the fact that, you know, your contribution and what is needed, what do you think is most pressing today?
My observation is that the countries that I have visited, maybe with the exception of a few and recently, have not put a lot of resources into healthcare. I will take an example as Ghana. That's where I'm from. My aunt died of something simple called DVT, which is a blood clot in the leg that traveled to her lung and she died. When she went to the hospital, the doctors are overwhelmed with seeing children with malaria, that everything that comes through is malaria till or proven otherwise. One, because the resources are not there, and two, it's not because of lack of expertise, they're just overwhelmed. And sometimes we ask the government maybe to try to do too much. And I think whether the government works to help or not, the private sector should just help and then just shine the light wherever they are. So my foundation is teaming up with another foundation that we are going to just focus on this small area and just make a difference, and hopefully it spreads.
Okay, now let's talk about your foundation, because one of the things that is very dear to your heart is to give back and contribute in your country, but also the continent at large at some point. So what are you focusing on?
So with the foundation, this is something that is, to me, is my life's work. So I've done a lot of medical missions, as you alluded to, into every part of the world. The thing that lacks in Africa is that, one, they don't have the facilities, but more importantly, they don't have the experts. And every year I'll go and I'll do 100 surgeries. The next year I go, there's still more 100 patients that I couldn't get to, and I'll go with a big team. So I realized that, you know, yes, you can go and do short trip surgeries, but that doesn't really increase capacity locally. So the foundation called the Foundation for Special Surgery, our focus is to actually build a facility that trains people locally so that we can get experts trained in Ghana, in Nigeria, from the West African region, Sub-Saharan region, coming to this place and learning something very specialized and keeping it in the area. To me, that's the way that we can make a long-lasting impact.
I was able to read a book that you wrote, the first book where you speak about your personal journey. Very, very fascinating story. What would you say about this book?
I've written a few books. Most of them have been scientific. This was quite difficult to do because you have to change from writing like a scientist to really be a storyteller. And when you go through the process, in the end, you exhale and you say, would anybody read this? But the experience has been illuminating to me. It's just saying where I came from, what my parents taught me, the stories they passed on to me, and how I got to where I am. And hopefully it would inspire people when they get to read it.
However far the stream flows. This is an African proverb, right?
Correct, it is. So there is an African proverb that however far the stream flows, it never forgets its source. I toyed about the titles for this book a lot, and it became an obvious title. My dad, when I was leaving Ghana, called me and said, I want to tell you a story that my mom told me. And the story goes this way, that when he was leaving his village, his mother called him to his small clay-thatched hut and told him to look at where she sleeps. And said, when you go to the big city, don't forget where your mother sleeps. So do not forget where you started from. So that if you get big, don't let your head get too big to forget where you came from.
What would people get out of reading this book?
The first thing I hope people do get out of this is that, one, it's important not to give up on your dreams. Second thing is not to underestimate small acts. I benefited from people doing little things that seemed insignificant, but to me changed the course of my life. And there's an African proverb again that I like. It said, if you think what you're doing is too small, that means you've never been in a room alone with a mosquito. That single little creature has caused so much mayhem in Africa from malaria, but it will keep you from sleeping at night. Small acts, like somebody just stopping when they were jogging to ask me, what are you going to do next year? That's what my professor did. Or someone stopping and looking at a kid who everybody thought was the village fool, the village idiot, because he couldn't speak properly, just because he had something we call a tight tongue, a thick frenulum, and once you snip it, the kid starts talking again. So little acts that we do can make difference in people. Small acts, like my mom prays for us every morning, and I overheard it every morning. Lastly, don't let anybody tell you no.
That's incredible. Now, when you look at your journey and so many young people in Africa and around the world are dreaming of coming to the U.S. or any other countries where they think they could pursue a career, but they're coming across challenges. What would you say? What would be your advice to them?
I was actually this is one of the reasons why I wrote this book because I do get tons of emails on a weekly basis. I still do, about students and parents emailing me and said, we read your story, we were inspired, we wanted to know how you made it. And even people ask me, what are my study habits?
Because you were excellent in school.
I did well. So they were looking for advice. What I would say is that you have to learn to be able to dream beyond your borders, beyond boundaries. To me, initially, when I thought this is what I wanted to do, it seemed like there was a very tall wall, too tall that I could look over. I wasn't tall enough ever to be able to surmount it. But if you set your sights on what you want to do, along comes people who see the effort you're putting in. And the proverbial African proverb is that when you're climbing a good tree, people sort of edge you up to the first branch. And I've had people sort of support me along the way. So what I would tell people who are trying from Africa or from any part of the world is that set your goals higher than you can ever think and just pursue it and make sure that every step gets you closer to that goal.
Great. And any final thoughts?
I am grateful that my family allowed me to be able to share their story, because their story is my story, and my patients as well, allowing me to share their stories. And hopefully this would be inspiring to other people as it's inspired me and my family as well.
And that was our exclusive interview with Dr. Kofi Owusu-Bwahini, Associate Professor at Johns Hopkins Medical Institute and a lead surgeon. Now, a report published in the medical journal The Lancet calls for major investment in surgery. VOA's Art Chimes has the report.
In its report published by The Lancet, the group says people are dying from conditions easily treated in the operating room, such as hernia, appendicitis, obstructed labor, and serious fractures. Stanford University surgery professor Thomas Weiser, a member of the Lancet Commission, says the need is great.
There are probably about 143 million operations that are needed just to meet basic needs in low and middle income countries. There are probably about 5 billion people that don't have access to safe, timely surgery with protection against catastrophic expenditure. And so those are, you know, pretty big numbers.
The Lancet Commission notes remarkable gains in global health over the last quarter century, but says surgery has not kept up with advances in other areas.
You can't achieve universal health care if you don't incorporate surgery.
Harvard Medical School's John Mira is one of the lead authors of the Lancet paper. Mira said increasing the availability of surgical treatments is not as simple as providing bed nets designed to protect against malaria. Surgery requires trained staff, proper facilities, and sterile instruments, but also reliable electricity, a system for getting patients to often distant hospitals, and a business model that does not bankrupt those who need an operation. The report suggests spending an additional $300 to $420 billion on surgery between now and 2030. That's a lot of money, but Mira says the Lancet Commission calculated each dollar spent would return $3 or $4 in economic benefit from lives saved and people returned to productive good health.
When you look at cost effectiveness in terms of dollars spent for welfare gains, for the positive impact on human beings, surgery is every bit as cost-effective as any of those other aspects.
There's no one best path for improving access to surgery, and the report cites several diverse countries, including Mexico and Rwanda, as having taken steps toward better availability of surgical services. For VOA News, this is Art Chimes reporting.
And finally, a VOA reporter, Lisa Schlein, has this story on the need for more surgeries and more funding in surgeries. Take a listen.
The World Health Organization reports more than 240 million surgical procedures are performed globally every year for a wide range of conditions, including cancer, heart disease, cataracts, and traffic crash injuries. Surgical site infections occur when bacteria enter a patient's body through incisions. They threaten the lives of millions of patients each year and contribute to the spread of antibiotic resistance. The UN agency says they are the most common hospital-acquired infection in poor countries and the second most common in rich countries. WHO Director of Service Delivery and Safety, Ed Kelly, says one in every 10 surgical patients in poor countries will get an infection. In some countries, he says, one-third of all patients coming in for surgery are infected.
In Africa, for instance, 20% of cesarean sections result in surgical site infections, which endanger, of course, the life of the woman and therefore the life of her baby. These result in hundreds of thousands of extra hospital days, billions of dollars in extra hospital costs, and tens of thousands of deaths.
The new guidelines cover 29 recommendations in 23 areas. Kelly says evidence shows that antibiotics given as close as possible before surgery can prevent infections for certain surgical procedures. But he says using antibiotics after surgery does not prevent infections. Another recommendation, he says, is not to shave patients before surgery.
Hair removal can actually increase the risk of causing microscopic cuts or traumas to the skin, and the evidence tells us that there's clear benefit to not removing the hair. If you had to boil it down globally as to what could have some of the biggest impact, this question of proper site preparation, proper hand hygiene, and really then the layout of the operating theater in terms of preventing infections.
Of the 29 recommendations in the guidelines, health officials cite hand washing as the single most important for preventing surgical site infections. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
And that was Lisa Schlein reporting. Now that's all the time we have for this edition of Health Chat. We thank our guests, Dr. Kofi Owusu-Derek Boahene, surgeon and author of the book, However Far the Stream Flows. You can find the book on Amazon and other outlets. For more on today's show, log on to our website at voanews.com/health or on facebook.com/voahealthchat. And let's keep the conversation going online. Send your questions or comments about any of our shows and future topics. I'm your host, Lenore Mudo in Washington, D.C., with producer Jackson Vungani and Eva Yuma for the news. Until next time, take care, be well, and strive to make every day a healthy day.